into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Yes, and very happy this evening to say we have this man with us, Rob Kearney, who's brought out his new book, No Hiding. Rob, thanks for joining us. You're very welcome.
Not at all. Thanks for having me on.
Just what you hate, a media interview.
Oh, I love them. I'm learning to love them. Especially with you, Joe.
Oh, well, listen. Let's review that in an hour. Let's see how we feel. So, let's jump right in. Second page of your book, I thought a line which stood out and made it very clear this wasn't all roses and plain sailing. This is just after the defeat to the All Blacks at the World Cup, and you're sitting on the bench and you know the game is over, and you say, I know the shit that I personally am going to take, and I know that I will take that shit personally. I know it will be heaped upon us as a team. Everybody has an opinion and we are entitled to everybody's opinion. If this is the end, I won't miss that constant noise. And then later on you say, that's it, I'm done. So done with international rugby. I've had my fill. It's all hassle. Too much stress and hassle. So that is not a man who's not loving all aspects of the glamour world of international rugby, to say the least.
No, I suppose, you know, you go through so many different emotions at a time like that. Where, you know, you've just been knocked out of the World Cup. You know, you haven't had your best game. The team hasn't had their best game. So there's so many different things that go through your head. And, you know, that was probably a very honest assessment of what I was feeling at that moment in time.
The noise did get to you. I was surprised the extent to which it did, but the noise did get to you.
Yeah, it did get to me. And, you know, it got to me a lot throughout my career. But I think it gets to a lot of people, you know. And, you know, it's very hard sometimes to ignore the noise. And even if, you know, I certainly genuinely wasn't one that was going out looking for opinions and assessments and all of these things, but it's hard to avoid sometimes. And, you know, you do take it personally because it's your livelihood, it's your job, it's your life. You're living and breathing everything to do with the game.
There was a lovely moment in the dressing room after that game where Joe Schmidt is saying his goodbyes effectively to lots of players, and there's a cue, and for different players, it's a different message. And a lot of them, it's you're the future now, or this is yours now, and you kick on now. And he gets to you and he says, 10 years, Carnes, we've been through so much, and tears break out. And you were through a lot. That really comes across in the book. And he mellowed with age, you say.
Yeah, he did in some respects. And, you know, he certainly upped the ante in other parts of his coaching as well. But, you know, we have been through a huge amount together. I've been lucky enough to have been with him from his first day in Leinster and his last day in Ireland. So there was lots of really great days. There was some bad days as well. But I think when I look back as a whole with my time with Joe, you know, we shared so many great successes together.
2016-17, it's very clear you're not enjoying your rugby. 2018 is a wonderful year for you for obvious reasons, and you do enjoy it. But speaking of Joe, I had wondered about that chat you had in the dressing room in Chicago before the New Zealand game. Your confidence was not high, to say the least. You weren't feeling good. And I did know that he had said to you, we need a big game from you today, Rob. You need a big game for you. I'd heard that. That was almost out in the public domain. Your reaction, though, is kickoff is maybe 4 minutes away tops. I'm thinking, F you, Joe. Why would you just say that to me before we go out to play the All Blacks? You know the way my head is. What the hell? It worked.
Yeah, it did work. But again, I suppose, like you say, my confidence was rock bottom at that time. I hadn't been playing well. My body kept breaking up on me. I wasn't able to string two games together back to back. And I suppose at a time like that, sometimes you feel, you know, you need people to put their arm around you. And, you know, some other coaches might have come up to you and said, listen, we still have faith in you. You know, you're a good player. We know you can do it today, as opposed to the other side of the coin when he told me you need a big game for yourself today. So straight away I'm thinking, okay, if I don't have a big game today, my international career could be over. So, you know, it was great. It worked out. I played well. We won the game. But, you know, I think Joe learned a little bit of a lesson from that day himself, that that was a tactic that he used with me down through the years after that as well, that he would always try and put me under a little bit more pressure than maybe he would with other people.
That's a bit of a theme in your career, and we'll revisit it at different points, but you, I sense, at different points would have appreciated a bit more support, a bit more of an arm around the shoulder, and yet various coaches looked at you and said, this guy is more of a stick than a carrot type. It mightn't have been how you felt, but that was their interpretation of you for whatever reason, it seems.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe that could be fair enough. Really good coaches know how to deal with individual players. And maybe, you know, Joe had learned down through the years that that was the way to sort of gee me up. And, you know, that there is an element of, you know, I'm going to show you as well. It starts the fire burning a little bit more. And, you know, there's definitely times that I look back in my career when, you know, I loved my back been against the wall on the big occasion, knowing that if I don't produce a performance today, I'm in big trouble. So there was an element of that, you know, a lot down throughout the years as well.
You've always struck me as a private person. I think you make that point in the book, but you do give lots of yourself in this book. So, for instance, if we jump back way back to Cooley, you make an interesting point. I don't know, stereotypes, you're, you know, successful rugby player, the jock, all that kind of stuff. You wouldn't have been candidate number one, I would have said, for bullying or being on the receiving end of it. But you make the point you didn't enjoy primary school. It was viewed as different. You would have been considered to have been from a privileged background. You know, the brothers were going to Clongowes, you were going to go to Clongowes. There was a who do you think you are aspect when it came to you in the area. You never mentioned it at home. You said at one point you live with this, the weight of it. You don't know what to do to stop it. Petered out maybe when you were 14, 15. But it's a sad thing, I suppose, to go through your primary school, those formative years, and to be on the receiving end of that.
Yeah, it is a sad thing, but I suppose, you know, you want to put stories into a book that maybe, you know, younger kids can relate to too. And I suppose when specifically with that story, you know, if I was 12 or 13 and I was looking at a rugby international who spoke about in his book that he endured some tough times in school with bullying and so on, that it probably would have made me feel a little bit better. You know, because rugby was all I wanted to do. And if I'm looking at, you know, the heroes of Irish rugby and guys who played rugby for the team, for the national team, knowing that they went through, you know, some tough days at school as well, that you try and make it relatable to some kids as well. So, you know, that was definitely an element of the whole thing. You say that, you know, I would probably be quite private down through the years, and I've given maybe a little bit more away in the book that I wanted to, and that is probably, you know, down to a good ghostwriter who managed to extract lots of little bits of information out of me.
Yeah, that being David Walsh in this instance. Have you reflected on how a formative experience like that has shaped you as an adult?
No, you never really know how growing up and the environment that you've grown up in and the difficulties that you've had growing up, you never really can quantify how much of an impact they have on you as a person. Now, of course, experiences like that, they do shape you, they shape your personality. You know, and who's to say that, you know, those few years of school, of primary school didn't have a positive effect on my mental resilience. It's hard to quantify these things, but you know, you always try and look back and take positives from, you know, some potentially negative experience that you had growing up.
It meant in part that you were very eager to get to Clongowes and spread your wings and get away from that environment. The Clongowes experience, so you say at one point, the day in general was, we were up at 7:30, studied from 8:30 to 9:15, class all day 9:30 to 3:30, sport was next 4:00 to 5:30, study again between 6 and 8, sport again or some other activity between 8 and 9, and then from third year onwards, study again 9 to 10 in the evening. That's a full-on schedule. You loved it though.
I did love it, and I suppose growing up as a kid, I always loved being busy, having something to do all day, every day. You know, I'd always ask my parents, what are we doing next? Where are we going to next? So getting away to school and having that amount of sport on a daily basis was great. The amount of study in there was probably a little bit excessive some days, but I was always busy. I was, you know, with a group of new friends, starting new relationships, and you know, I was really excited to get to Clongowes. And I suppose after a few months in there, I just knew straight away, yeah, this is the place for me.
A lot of those friendships have endured as well. It's very striking.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the things with boarding school is that you're living with these guys, you know, for 28 days of the month. So, you know, in some respects, they're, you know, they are like brothers. And, you know, I've built up a lot of relationships with guys who I went into school with at 13 years of age. And those relationships that I have now with them would be as strong as the relationships that I would have, you know, with my two brothers. So there's definitely an element of when you're living with each other and you're on top of each other all day, that those relationships are a lot stronger than you might get with guys who would go to a day school.
So Leinster then, I mean, you really are one of the last of the generation that were changing out of the backseat of their cars. I can only imagine what the younger Leinster players now must think when you say that they're in a dressing room with someone who didn't have a dressing room. So this is old school initially. And that certainly applies to Michael Checa and his approach to you. It's tough. It was really tough, to say the least. If I made a mistake, it was showcased in the video session ad nauseum. If any of the older lads made mistakes, Checa didn't embarrass them by putting them on the screen. I was always the one who got the brunt. You say, I just didn't like having Checa as a coach for those years. He was there for 5 years through till 2010. It was only at the very end that things approached us. And then the line that jumped out to me, even now years later, if I see Checa, even after an international, I'll say hello, nice to see you again. But if I'm being honest, I've never really forgotten those early days.
Yeah, like this was probably the one area that not that I went hardest on someone, but, you know, maybe doesn't come out of it looking all great and smelling of roses. Now, at the same time, I've tried to be very fair in the book as well. And I do highlight lots of times, you know, the unbelievable impact that he's had on Leinster and how he reformed us as a club in those earlier years. And, you know, how he got us that first Heineken Cup trophy, which was unbelievable. He turned the club around. But at the same time, you know, he definitely did give me a hard time. And, you know, there was a lot of those Monday mornings going in for those video review sessions that, you know, I'd be sitting in my car out in the car park, not really wanting to go into work on the Monday morning for, you know, for a 19, 20-year-old who's just starting out in professional rugby and living his dream and doing what he always wanted to do, you know, it probably wasn't the healthiest of places for me.
No, it certainly didn't come across that way. And actually, Brian's going to be on later on, Brian O'Driscoll. There was a cliquey atmosphere in the Leinster dressing room at that time. And that doesn't help either. It's not like you're a 19-year-old going in there and the dressing room at large is welcoming you in and how are you and know your name. It was a different time and it was a bit cliquey. So it doesn't sound like you felt this is a very hospitable place. I wondered to what extent it might have inhibited you as a player in hindsight.
Yeah, again, you know, it's hard to quantify that. You know, you take a young guy in and you fill him up with confidence and you let him go out and express himself on the weekend and you don't pull him up too much on his performances. And, you know, you could potentially see a different type of player. But, you know, then again, I look back on those years with Checa and all the hard times he gave me. And I do wonder that if they were really good for me in other areas, if he hardened my mind, that mental resilience that I spoke about. Because there was other guys, young guys in the environment too, who he probably went hard at as well. Not as hard as me, but, you know, there was a few guys in there who couldn't handle it. And, you know, they ended up either moving on or giving up. Or they just found that the whole environment a little bit too tough. So, you know, I look back now and again, I try and take the positives from it. And you know, I'd like to think that the way he treated me, I was able to use in some shape or form for the next 15 years of my career.
Because it doesn't actually, at no point in the book do I get the sense you're so fed up with it that you're going to quit. Like, you talk about being in the car there and dreading going in, but I don't think there's ever a question of, well, I'm not going to go in.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. No, there wasn't. There was never. There was times when I was like, oh, I don't want to go in these doors now for another video recession where I'm going to get opened up.
Yeah.
But no, I was never close to anything along the lines of not going in and never coming back.
It was notable even after the Lions tour of 09, where you burst on the scene in a global way, frankly, that your first game back for Leinster, you're back on the bench and there's a degree of, just get back in your box now, son. You know who's boss around here and the way this works. But I mentioned the Lions tour of 09, and we must have, a similar time during lockdown, watched repeats of that tour, and you mentioned in the book watching back that second test. And I was even curious to see, was Rob Kearney as good in that as I remember? And I mean, it's outrageous. And you talk about it being, you know, the game of your life, frankly, a perfect state of flow. You're hitting Gary Owen spirals, you're catching everything, you're making breaks. That was kind of as good as it gets in some way from a performance point of view. I mean, a day like that on that stage, I think you were even a bit in shock afterwards. How the hell did that go so well?
Yeah, I definitely was, because, you know, I had been through a pretty tough time the 3-4 months prior to that. So I got the mumps after the quarterfinal of the Heineken Cup in 2009, and that really knocked me. I was in the Blackrock Clinic for 10 days. I'd lost, I think, 7 or 8 kilos of muscle mass, and before I went on that Lions tour, I'd only played one game for Leinster. So I was on the back foot, and I was never really sort of expecting to pull out a performance like that. I got on the plane to South Africa and I was just happy to be there. And I was hoping, okay, I might get a couple of games for the Lions, probably won't feature in the test. Lee Byrne is ahead of me. He's playing the rugby of his life. And I suppose you fast forward on 4 or 5 weeks and I look at what ended up happening, and, you know, there definitely was an element of how did that happen. And there's so much luck that goes down through the years, and guys getting the right side of luck at important points of their career. And I would definitely say that was the single biggest period in my career when, you know, I was just blessed with a little bit of luck.
Mm. You make a really interesting observation. So if we talk about your game as a whole and how it's perceived. So you talk about that test in 09, watching it back now, and you say, nowadays, I can hardly recognise that young guy. I don't know when I stopped being that bold and confident. When did the risks begin to weigh me down? I was so much more at ease with myself as a player back then. The older I have got, the more my game has become a constant worry about limiting my mistakes. 51% defender, 49% attacker. Why did that happen, do you think?
It probably happened for a few reasons. So the game definitely changed a huge amount. You know, you look back at those games in 2009, and rugby is a different game in terms of how it's played. I think mistakes are punished an awful lot more now, particularly in the backfield area, the role of the fullback. And, you know, I think as I got a little bit older as well, you sort of understand and appreciate the importance of fewer mistakes. Joe came in as a coach, and I was very aware of his philosophy in terms of, you know, the less mistakes, the better. And, you know, I definitely do feel that throughout my whole career, I was always more worried about limiting my mistakes than I was about doing the really impressive, flashy things.
Because it's clear, I mean, not least in 16-17, but generally you're aware of a perception that where's the champagne rugby from full back, you know. But reading the book, I felt you were unaware of just how appreciated you have been as well as a player. You know, even like at times you're citing different criticisms that have come your way. And I'm thinking, is the good stuff not reaching this guy as well? Because at times, you know, before most Ireland matches, well, it's Kearney steady as a rock. And that was a good thing. And yet I felt you were hearing the critiques far more than a lot of the good press you were getting. Even take the last couple of years. You know, Robbie Henshaw plays against England in 19 in Dublin. I mean, that was a week where your name was mentioned nonstop, and the value of what you do. So I wonder, were you unaware of the positive things which were said about you as well?
I think human nature makes us sort of feel that we only pay more attention to the negative stuff. You know, I was aware of the positive stuff, but I was also conscious that, you know, I didn't want to put too much of that into the book. No one wants to read a book about you, you know, highlighting all the great things that you've done or the times that the team missed you and whatnot. And,
yeah.
And I suppose I would have used a lot of the negative stuff to drive me on as well. And I wanted to highlight some of my motivations and driving forces that I would have used to help me to perform. And that was probably more of a reason for putting that stuff in, okay, as opposed to recognizing the good moments.
Okay, because I was starting to think, does this guy think he was hated for about the last 10 years of his career or something? So it's good to know. You do make give us some interesting insights into your approach to the game. Like, for instance, one of the criticisms would be that you might catch a ball at fullback and just run straight towards the biggest person you can find in front of you. There's no sidestep. Run at the biggest person I see. And you cite Paul O'Connell, who said to you that was the best thing he could see, because then from a team point of view, they saw you running straight. They knew exactly where that first breakdown was going to be, and it was a way to get quick ball going and momentum going. So we mightn't have, you know, four or five phases later, no one is saying, geez, Carney did very well to run straight at the big guy and go nowhere. But that was part of your thinking.
Yeah, it was definitely part of my thinking and how I played the game. I suppose winning the halfway line was always something that I would use as a trigger for myself to try and get there as quickly as possible. Now, I also say that, you know, I wouldn't have had the most amazing footwork to be able to sidestep lads and you know, beat a couple of players in a box of a few meters, but it became and has become more difficult to counterattack when teams are just playing 13 men front line. There's no chinks in their line. It's pretty difficult to get through them sometimes. And if you do try and sidestep and you get caught in a side-on tackle, you know, you just leave yourself a lot more open to getting counter-rocked or getting pinched, getting the ball pilfered on the deck. So, you know, while it wasn't sexy rugby, you know, I would sort of felt that it was effective rugby. Mm. And if I can just make sure that we get the ball back cleanly and relatively quickly, and what we might do a few phases after that, like you say, can have a positive impact on the team, you know, that's all that I really cared about, to be honest.
Yeah. You say that of the nines and tens down the years, when you're guarding the backfield, they always take a glance. Quick glance, it may be, but always take a quick glance at where they're going to kick it. Except one, and it made Dan Carter pretty much impossible to defend against at times. That was a really interesting insight. I was surprised it was only just one who was. I'm surprised they're all taking glances.
To be fair, Johnny has done it now in training down through the years. The two of us would have had some good, enjoyable battles.
You mentioned the Carter thing to him, didn't you?
We would have spoken about it years ago.
Right.
And, you know, down in training through the years, we might have a coffee or, you know, a cheeky 10-euro bet if he can find grass or let the ball bounce in the backfield against me. But, you know, anticipation was something that was always really important for me and my game. Mm. You know, I would be obsessed with not letting the ball bounce in the backfield when I was playing fullback. And, you know, you get so many cues from the eyes of number 9 and 10 that invariably, like you say, they will always look where they're going to kick the ball before they do it. And, you know, little things like that were really important for me in terms of how I anticipate the next phase or two of a game.
Well, it's striking as well. You say that from about 27, 28, you got very serious about becoming a student of the game. And that when you watch a game now, and this must be very annoying for anyone watching with you, but you will say aloud to yourself what you think is going to happen next. So, i.e. he's going to go short side, he's going to kick. You are constantly watching this game in the future. Are you going to drop that habit when you retire?
I don't think so, because it's always the way that I've watched rugby.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I do take my eye off the ball a little bit in terms of what happens at the breakdown and how teams might be defending. I'm very much focused on just the backfield and what's happening in backfield when I'm watching games. And, you know, like you say, I do regret not trying to become a much better student of the game earlier on in my career. Mm. You know, in my early 20s, I didn't really understand the game too much. I was just more concerned about my own game and what I needed to do to be a good fullback. But over the last few years, particularly with Joe and Stuart Lancaster in their style of coaching, they make sure that players have a deep understanding of how they want to play the game.
Yes. Like you say, and Lancaster's a big figure in this book, considering of all the years he's worked with you for a relatively small percentage of those years. So you say Michael Cech and David Knox, I don't think got the best from me. With Declan Kidney and with Eddie O'Sullivan, I don't think fullback play would have been their forte. Eddie was abstract and distant, and I never knew him. We'll talk about Declan Kidney a bit later on when Alan Quinlan joins us, and we'll talk a bit about Ireland. But you say Joe, of course, has been a huge influence with me on Leinster and with Ireland. I've done more sessions, more reviews with Joe than anybody else, shared more success with him. Given all that, I've been surprised at how much I've come to appreciate Stuart Lancaster at Leinster at this stage of my career, when I clearly know I'm not his cup of tea when it comes to fullbacks. It's an interesting dynamic, yours with Lancaster. You know he wants a playmaker type at 15. I mean, he's completely explicit in that with you. And, you know, you say at one point you've argued, well, shouldn't the 12 be more of a playmaker too? And he said, yes, that's fine, but I want a playmaker at 15. So, you know, this shouldn't be a nice mixture, but actually you hold him in unbelievably high esteem and his rugby intellect in unbelievably high esteem.
Yeah, like, you know, you have to be honest as well. And although that I, like you say, I wasn't necessarily his type of fullback play, you have to appreciate that he's a superb coach. And he is a superb coach. And he's done unbelievable things for Leinster. And he'll continue to do great things for Leinster. And I'm sure he will probably go into an international job at some point in the future. He definitely improved my understanding of the game. I think I improved as a player under him in the last few years as well. Mm. And I suppose even, you know, last year, 34 years of age, there was still elements that I was trying to improve on in terms of my own game, and they would very much have been a directive of his. Mm. One thing Stuart has said to me on numerous occasions that he wished he had coached me earlier on in my career, that he thinks he could have maybe molded me more into the type of fullback that he wanted.
Right.
But in saying that, I still enjoyed a huge amount of success with Leinster in the last few years. And like you say, 2018 was really a pinnacle year for me in terms of my own career.
Mm. And, you know, it's really clear. 2018, you say you went out to appreciate the fact that you were playing this sport and you'd got your body right. There's a big figure, we won't have time to say more than a line on him, Enda King in Santry, who sorts your body out, you know? I mean, from a courtesy of a weight session at 19 where you're lifting too heavy a weight, you have back problems and it's a big issue. And towards the end of your career, you get to grips with that. So where I'm going with this is Joe Schmidt's legacy is unbelievable. You know, he's the best coach Ireland has ever had. I think that much we can agree on. And so unfairly, but because I'm interested, I'm going to ask you about 19. I didn't get a sense from you too much in 19 that there was great panic after the Six Nations of 19. You know, the England defeat, the Wales defeat in Cardiff, Ehrestrom game against Italy, the warm-up game against Twickenham was off the back of the week in Portugal. I got the sense, okay, Japan felt like a bit of an ambush to everybody. And then even the week before the New Zealand game, you say the preparation was really good. Like, we went into that game confident, which it's kind of amazed at. On the outside, it looked like 2019 never got any momentum, never worked. Why do you think that is, if you had to give a core reason?
If I had to give a core reason, I would say, I think in 2018, we were number one team in the world. So we'd won the Six Nations. We'd just beaten New Zealand at home. We'd won the three test tour down in Australia. I think there was an element within the group that our game now is really good. We're the best in the world. We don't have to change it too much. If we continue to do what we're doing, that we will be a force with every other team in the world. I think number two team in the world, down to number six, said, okay, we need to start changing our game a little bit now. We can't compete with the Irish in terms of the style that they're playing. We all have to go and adapt our game and try and find a new way of playing. And if I think that is what caught us out in the end, that we tried with the tried and tested what was working for us, what got us to number one team in the world. And then when 2019 came along, all these other teams started to play a different brand of rugby. And I just don't think we were able to compete with them as well as we had done in the few years before that.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, it's so easy to say, well, God, we should have evolved too. But I don't remember anybody saying that around January 2019 time. I mean, it would have been difficult to go, let's tear up the script here. So it's very understandable how it happened.
I think that's the other really important point that you make. You know, Twickenham was a real alarm bell for us, but you're almost sort of too late in the journey to start thinking, right, we need to start changing how we're playing here. You just rely on trying to do what you have done, but maybe do it a little bit better. But definitely, you know, I look back on that Twickenham game now and you step back from the whole thing and you say, well, it's clear as daylight. They are some warning signs. The alarm bells are ringing for you. You need to do something different. And, you know, I think that's probably an area where we just glanced over a little bit.
In a few moments' time, we'll be joined by Brian O'Driscoll as well. But Rob, I want to talk to you about the body as you head off to Australia, because you've taken some punishment, to say the least. I mentioned that weight session with Gervin Dempsey when you were 19 years of age and you're lifting too heavy a weight and it causes a back issue, which then has ramifications for much of your career. And I'd say I got the distinct impression you will not miss the ticking clock across a week, the how am I on a Wednesday, how am I on a Thursday, a Friday, Saturday morning, I'm really pushing it. And in certain instances, you just should not play. And I would say more often than not, you find a way to get out there and get through a lot of games in fairly rickety shape.
Yeah, that's the single biggest thing that I won't miss is the mental battles that you have with yourself during the week as to whether your body is ready for a test match, if you've fronted up, if you're going to be able to do your job. You know, there's so many times down through the years that I've been standing in the anthem, singing the anthem, wondering, am I fit enough to play this game? And invariably you come through it and adrenaline and all these things work out in your favor. But, you know, like I say, that is the single biggest thing that I won't miss.
Like, you talk multiple epidurals, nerve root blocks, 10 to 15 of them, maybe too many you concede, but you were desperate. And that was particularly clear in advance of the New Zealand game at the Aviva 2018. Ultimately, a game I'm sure you were glad you started. But, I mean, you were risking fairly severe damage to yourself. Remind us of what happened there.
Yeah, it was 3 weeks before the New Zealand game. I picked up an SC injury in Treviso in Italy that I subluxed my ex-SC joint. I think it was maybe 40% backwards. And, you know, there was talk of surgery the week after the game, and I came into camp for the start of that November internationals, and the doctor, Kieran Cosgrave, was saying, listen, mate, we're going to have to send you back home. You're not going to be fit to play for, you know, for at least a few weeks, maybe even months. So, like you say, I was so desperate to play in those big games. And had it been in the midst of Pro 14 season, you know, I could easily have taken 6-8 weeks off before I would have been back, recovered and fit to play rugby again. But, you know, I knew the All Blacks were coming to town. It was 1v2 in the world. The team was going well. And I don't think I'd have been able to live with myself looking at a team sheet of that day and seeing someone else's name at number 15, knowing that I could have potentially played it.
You almost, like, it really captures that players will do anything to play. On the issue, say, of painkillers, which have arisen in the last while, and the cliche that they're handed out like Smarties, and we're told that has changed somewhat. To what extent has that changed now?
Yeah, like, I don't think they were ever really handed out like Smarties. Certainly, they were more easily accessed back when I started off 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
It has tightened up massively in the last number of years, to the point now that only the team doctor can administrate the drugs on a Monday to Friday. You know, but I wanted to give a little bit of an honest insight as well, that there was times when, you know, I'd taken my fair share of them and I needed to take them to help me get through training or to help me get through a game. Mm. And, you know, if you've got an aid there that enables you to train on a Monday, Tuesday, get you selected for a team, or to, you know, allow you get on the field and feel a little bit better on a Saturday afternoon, you know, they were some of the decisions that you know, you have to take. And it gives a little bit of an insight as well that, you know, you're prepared to, you know, to push your body to the nth degree in terms of what it can do to try and get out in that field and make sure that you can do your job as best you can.
Yeah. You're an elder statesman now and you've been around a long time. The issue of anti-doping has become a huge one across the course of your career. So, for instance, in 2018, rugby became the second most tested sport, up 60% actually, 2018, and that's continued. And John Tracy, the CEO of Sport Ireland at the time, said, that graph speaks for itself in terms of where we see the risks. Can you allay fears or suspicions that people may have about the integrity of the sport, or have you seen things which concern you?
When I read all these articles and I see the graphs and quotes like that, I wonder if I'm unbelievably naive as to what potentially is going on out there. But, you know, I can categorically say in my 15 years, it's never even been spoken about, that it is that much of a non-event, certainly in Ireland. And, you know, I'm unbelievably surprised that there is still discussions about rugby and doping going on. And that's why I wonder, am I, you know, very naive to what's going on in the world? But certainly from my perspective and what I've seen on this island, you know, I've never been in any way exposed to even discussions about it.
And further afield, do you have concerns? You know, Gordon Darcy was writing recently about reservations over South Africa joining up internationally, and from a club point of view, one of the reasons, and it wasn't, to be fair to Gordon, the only reason, but one of the reasons he mentioned was their track record on this issue. Further afield, it does seem like the game does have some issues.
Yeah, further afield, you know, I think there is probably a lot more fears outside of Ireland about the game. You know, you do have to look at track records and see what has gone on in certain countries down through the years. And you've mentioned South Africa, and they have had their own problems with doping down through the years. So you'd have to say that they would probably be higher on the list than some of the other countries who've never really had a problem with it. I think it's one, like all sport, that we need to keep a pretty close eye on and, you know, make sure that we are governing it as best as we possibly can.
As you depart now for Australia, how is your body and how will your body be in 15, 20 years?
Body's is pretty good.
Right.
You know, you've mentioned the back injury. Yeah, if I could take one day back in my career, it would be that time that I tried to clean jerk 90 kilos without really having too much of an understanding about what clean jerking actually is.
Yeah.
You know, the knees and ankles are a little bit stiff and sore sometimes. But as a whole, you know, physically, I've come out the other end in a really good position. Mm. You know, I am number 15. I was at the back of the field. So I haven't had to put my body through the same amount of work and collisions and impacts as some of the other guys, particularly in the pack and in the center. But, you know, I'm very lucky to be able to say that physically I'm in a pretty, pretty good position now. And if you had asked me when I was starting out, what sort of position do you think your body will be in when you're close to retirement, I would have taken where I'm at now 100%.
Right, okay. I saw when you announced the decision that you're going to Australia, Brian O'Driscoll responded on Twitter with the congratulations and then several bags of cash to say have a good time. What is your mindset going out there? What are you hoping to get from it? And you know, because you could easily just hang up your boots very clearly. So what's the thought process here going out to Australia?
Well, I'll start off by saying that it is absolutely not several bags of cash. Physically, I felt good.
Right.
Mentally, I wanted to keep on playing. You speak to guys who have retired and they give you the advice of play as long as you can, keep going as long as you can. So you take their advice on board a little bit, that once you stop and you can't go back. I always wanted to do a little bit of traveling when I finished up with Leinster. I wanted to get away from Dublin, get away from the bubble that is Leinster and Dublin Four, because it's all I know. I came straight out of school, straight into professional rugby. Leinster rugby in Dublin is all I've ever experienced. So to get the opportunity then to go away to a new country, Australia, somewhere that I love. Super 15 is a great competition. I don't think I'll be playing in it now next year. The most likely it'll be just a competition amongst the Australian teams. But this last season has been particularly unfulfilling for me. I haven't played a huge amount of rugby. Playing in stadiums with no fans, it was just a very sort of, it wasn't how I anticipated my career to end. So to be given an opportunity to go and do something different in a new place, a new environment, it was just too good to turn down. And it is only a 6-month contract. It's not 12 months. So, you know, it seemed like a really good fit for me for where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, no, it sounds great. One last point to touch on before we bring up Brian O'Driscoll and let you go. You talked about this in the Late Late Show, and it's clearly a very difficult thing to talk about. And it was the passing of your brother Ross when he was in a traffic accident at the age of 6. You were 2. What really jumps out, and it's a theme running through the book, is that the family have stayed very mindful of him. And yet you make the point that you didn't feel like there was a huge cloud over your childhood either. And ultimately, testament to your parents, and like what a courageous thing to try and deal with that and carry on. And you talk about, you know, it shows the strength of their marriage. They're the heroes of the book in many ways, aren't they?
They certainly are. And, you know, they're the heroes to me. And I know everyone says their parents are great, but I just have an incredible amount of admiration for how they were able to deal with such a tragic event and keep the show on the road to, you know, where I'm now saying that, you know, it had no impact on my life. And I have a nephew now who's 6 years of age, and a lot of friends who have kids who are 6 years of age. And I just think that if they went through the same thing, that it would just turn their world upside down. So, you know, they're definitely the heroes in the book. It was a way for me to honor Ross as well. And, you know, to also state as well how he's not been with us. I do believe that he has been the glue that has kept our family so close together down through the years. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I just wanted to honor in a way that was right, that reflected positively on all parties involved.
Did you find you spoke to your parents more about the experience that they went through in writing this book, or is it still not something necessarily that you get into the weeds of with them?
No, it's something that we'd spoken more and more when I was going through the detail of it for the book. And, you know, it was actually a really positive experience for us as a family to start discussing things again. And certainly my conversations with Richard when we were getting into the real in-depth details of that day and his recollection of them was something that I'd never discussed with him before. And, you know, so as a family, I think it was a really good thing for us that, not that we didn't speak about it before, but we just brought the level of conversation to a new depth now. That I think had a real positive impact on all of us over the last few months.
And what's your sense, finally, of how your parents managed to cope? I mean, I can't imagine. You said yourself you'd see friends with kids of that age. It's hard to imagine. What is your sense of how they managed to cope?
It's a tough question, really. you know, I suppose they will both say that they were very lucky that they were young enough to have more kids. And, you know, Dave came along, I think, maybe a year after the accident. And then 3 years after that, my younger sister, Sarah, who we will always sort of say that, that she was a gift from Ross after having four boys, that a girl came along. You know, I think how they dealt with it, you know, I said on the Late Late Show that how they managed to create an environment for all of us growing up that felt really normal. And I think that's the biggest compliment that I can pay to them. When their life had been turned upside down and the environment that they were living in was anything but normal, but to still be able to raise, you know, kids in an environment where we felt it was very normal, full of love, all of the things that, that you'd expect with a new young family. Mm. I think that is probably the best way that I can sum up how they managed it.
We're talking about Rob Kearney, his new book, No Hiding, out now. Very final section before we wrap things up. Brian Driscoll's going to join us as well. Back in one sec.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.